Hello, and welcome to Dead Times, the only horror movie podcast recorded in the middle of an active crime scene. I'm yours, Peter, and with me, as always, is Stringer, Tim. Tim, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Peter, and I just want to say that you will not regret giving me this opportunity, because I believe that you get out of work what you put into it.
Have you been attending some business seminars?
Oh, no, but you can learn everything online if you look for it.
Yeah. And tonight, we are going to be talking about the film Nightcrawler. About
the best X-Men movie.
Yeah.
Eat your heart out, Logan.
It's a film about how the real horror is the local news.
Yeah, whoever I bet you never thought it was them. They're the ones distracting you all the time.
Yeah, whoever wrote this film obviously has a Sinclair Broadcast Group local news station.
Local news is often pretty fucked, in fairness. It's a bit of a fair target, and there are obviously broader targets implicated in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is a very good movie that we're doing for a very stupid reason.
Yeah, what is that reason, Peter?
This is our Pride Month special.
Hell yeah!
Which there's a long and very dumb story behind it, but like the day before June started, Amazon put all of Jake Gyllenhaal's movies on sale. Like, and it wasn't even like an announced sale.
I was wondering exactly how this happened. That was the key piece of information I was lacking. All right, I'm up to speed now.
Yeah, so Amazon put all of Jake Gyllenhaal's movies on sale. And this wasn't like an announced sale. Like when Barbie came out, they put all of Margot Robbie and Ryan Gosling's movies on sale. Like if you just went to their for sale or their sales page and click through all of them, and you happen to know the titles of a bunch of Jake Gyllenhaal movies, all of them were on sale. And that struck me as extremely funny.
They can't have not known what they were doing.
Yeah. Someone on Amazon knew what they were doing. So I wound up getting like a bunch of them, which filled out my Jake Gyllenhaal film collection. But then like after this, someone asked me what this was on the internet. Someone asked me what I was going to be doing or for, like, I think it was for the Pride Parade. And the thing is that the first day of June was the first Saturday, and my local big city decided to have the Pride Parade on the first day of June. And like, I didn't even Google it until like May 29th. And I'm like, oh, well, I guess I'm not going to the parade.
So we're speed running our civil rights this year. Okay.
Yeah. Which like the thing is that my local big city coordinates with the other relatively big cities in the area so that people can attend all of them. So they always get the first Saturday of the month. But like it's super poor planning. Like have you met gay people? Like they're not going to be checking to see if it's the first Saturday of the month. But anyway, so I said, well, since I can't go to the parade because it's the first day of the month, and I didn't obviously take the time off work to go to it, I'm like, I guess what I'm doing is I'm going to do the gayest thing possible and watch a bunch of Jake Gyllenhaal movies, which I just bought six of them.
Which is presumably why that noble Amazon employee did this.
Yeah.
It's just to put something out there for the gays that couldn't make it out to Pride. This is exactly the experience that was in mind here.
Because Jake Gyllenhaal is the film gay person's gay icon.
He is a beautiful, beautiful man. It's even in this movie. And he's a fucking creep in this movie. You can still see it. You can still kind of imagine the story, you know?
Yeah. Which, as the fact that he's the only living star of Brokeback Mountain, he fairly regularly plays gay or queer roles. And he is not afraid to show off.
I have actually not seen him in that many things. I was going through it before we started the episode. I was trying to think. I know I've seen him in the something big other than this. I saw most of, when I was working at the movie theater in 2019, I saw most of the Far From Home, which I do think is kind of a bullshit movie and very emblematic of Marvel's bullshit of that time onwards. That is the movie that gave us the "bitch please you've been to space" exchange, which kind of sums up my problems with the franchise right there. But Gyllenhaal is pretty great in that movie. I think he maybe put to work some of the stuff that he learned making this movie, because he is very good at just very, very obviously not at all being the person that he's pretending to be. So he is really good in that. I know I've seen like one other thing that he had a big role in. I'm trying to remember what it is. I will Wikipedia his filmography while I bounce it back to you.
Yeah. But so he has been in a lot of...
He's a lovely actor.
Yeah, no, he's really good. He's a Nepo baby, but he's a good Nepo baby. Like, he's the kind of Nepo baby that you feel like would have a career even if he wasn't related to people that are very important to Hollywood.
The early stuff I've seen October Sky, and I've seen Donnie Darko. And so those would be the big things I know from, especially Darko.
Yeah. But
yeah, he's good. He's not and there is something particularly appealing about Jake Gyllenhaal, I think. Just as an actor, he's not. I don't know. There's just something very not typical leading man about him to me. You know, obviously he doesn't have a typical leading man in role in this movie. I don't know. There's something kind of like James Deaney about his delivery. You know, he's kind of quiet, but even when he's projecting, even when he's asserting power in the scene, that there will still be something kind of reserved about him, which makes him really perfect for this role. I don't know. I feel like I'm thinking back to Far From Home, and I do think that Far From Home is kind of a dumb movie in a lot of ways, but like just the way that he might approach any performance, I feel like there will be layers of subtlety that he brings to it that you wouldn't necessarily get from somebody else in that role. You always feel like that guy's thinking, you know, like he's doing something, he's presenting something to whoever he's talking to, but that there's definitely something going on that he's not necessarily showing all of. It makes me think about, I always said that Soderbergh was really good at directing people this way. I remember saying once that Soderbergh is able to direct and shoot people in such a way that you feel like you are looking at people who are very, very slightly on fire. And that they're just having these regular interactions, but that there is some aspect of them that is actively on fire at every moment. And I feel like that Jake Gyllenhaal is good at projecting something similar.
Yeah. Like, he gives really good performances even when, like, it wasn't necessarily called for. Like, he was in... His most recent movie is a remake of Roadhouse, which is just, like, in general, a very strange choice for him. But, like, he's very good in it, and he gives that character a lot more depth than I think the script necessarily would imply.
Right, yeah, yeah, that's what I'm saying. I feel like he can put subtleties into how he performs that communicates a lot more than the script gives you. This movie, I think, has a brilliant screenplay, but it is very lean in a lot of ways, and we are very deliberately choosy with what we reveal about this character. But you understand this character very, very well past a certain point in the movie, and that is mostly down to the way that Gyllenhaal plays him.
Yeah. He is great. I really love him. I really love his performance in this movie.
Yeah, it's I don't 100% know if I can think of another performance like his performance in this movie. And this is a movie very much built around showcasing this character. There are a couple of supporting characters who are important, but he is very, very close to being like the only character to have a full character presence in the story. There are movies like this, obviously. All of the movies that people compared Joker to when it came out, you could compare this movie to. There are elements of like Taxi Driver, of some other gritty, sleazy Los Angeles crime and crime adjacent thrillers. And there are characters like this, there is this whole sort of tradition of movies built around characters like this. Although this character never did get a spot in the Sigma pantheon alongside Arthur Fleck and Patrick Bateman and all the rest of them. So they never really picked up on this one. I don't know whether that's because I don't really know honestly how well this movie is remembered. I've just always known about it because I remember when it came out. I remember seeing a positive review of it and thinking that really sounds up my street. I should check it out. And I never did. Which would have been 10 years ago then. And just somehow it never left my mind. But I don't see people talk about this movie very much. So I don't know if it just kind of slipped by. If you just can't quite bring yourself to think that this guy is cool in the way that you can think Patrick Bateman or the Joker is cool. Because again, it's not like those performances. There are other movies like this that are built around characters kind of like this, but the nature of this character and the way that, that Gyllenhaal especially portrays him, I don't know if I can think of anything else really like it. And it is unnerving from the get-go. You feel like you're watching a movie about an alien, about something genuinely alien to your conception of what a person is, just sort of right from the get-go.
I believe that Lou in this movie is some form of sociopath.
Well, I mean, the first thing that he does is kill somebody. It seems very, very clear. The point of it is that he's a sociopath who knows how to succeed as a sociopath. Might be a serial killer. Who knows? We don't know at all what he was up to before the plot of this movie. We get the barest hint of how he spent his time around the fringes of Los Angeles up to that point. But the key thing about this movie is about this movie is about a sociopath in his natural habitat, in like his ideal environment, in the environment where he can just really put in a lot of good work and succeed and get ahead in life. And that having him respond to that, you know, this is the thing, is that this is a movie about a sociopath who does face pressure over the course of the movie. But there is some threat of him being found out and being caught some of the time. But mostly he's kind of on top of his game. We're used to seeing movies about sociopaths who have their games and then the game unravels. But this one found the right game to play, clearly. But he found a game that he, as he points out himself several times throughout the movie, he found something that he not only loves to do, but happens to be really good at. So it plays very differently, and his energy in the movie is very different, I feel. I get from lots of depictions of characters like this, that he's just in his element. You're getting more uncomfortable because things are getting crazier and crazier around him. And our audience surrogate character is certainly getting more and more uncomfortable throughout the movie. But he just kind of remains unflappable. It's very rare that anything really enters into his life in the course of this movie that constitutes a genuine obstacle for him. it's the way that the character is portrayed, but also the story and what the character is portrayed as experiencing. Really makes it unique, I think. So again, I can't really think of another performance like this, of a character like this being played like this, in large part just because of the context, because of what happens with that character is so different from what tends to.
Yeah, this character is probably the worst character of the entire movie, and that includes multiple murderers.
Yep. And Rene Russo, who is clearly an awful person too.
Yeah, well, the thing is that Lou never has a single consequence for anything that he does in this movie. Like, he's just constantly doing awful things, and then you find out more awful things he's done, and there's no consequences to it.
Like, he'll get inconvenienced for a little bit. He has to talk to some detectives for a little bit, but he doesn't mind doing that. Lou is a very, very patient man.
Yeah. Like, it is... Yeah. It's such an interesting thing because of the fact that, like, the argument that the movie makes is that everyone involved in this industry, which again is local news, is a terrible human being. But Lou's success seems entirely because of the fact that he is so much worse than everyone else that even they are shocked.
Yeah, but that consistently the way people respond to encountering somebody with even less scruples and morals than them is, holy shit, where's this guy been our whole life? Mm-hmm. You know, man, I want to be that guy. I want to be like him. I find him inspiring.
Yeah. You feel more motivated to succeed in your career now?
Not exactly. That was not exactly the impression that this movie left me with. but that is exactly what it's about, obviously. This is on one level, I think, unavoidably a black comedy. And the point of it is that this is the American success story that we all tell ourselves. With everything that we tell ourselves about how to succeed in this society, you should be rooting for Lou. But might even find yourself doing so for moments at a time. But he's putting lots of work into it. He's trying to be good at something, which is hard. But in those scenes where he's getting his incredible shots that he wants to get so badly. With the way that the music is and the way that it's shot, it's like this great moment of triumph for this character, is the way that it's portrayed, and that it's the kind of triumph that we are told to relish in, to strive after in our own lives. Except that it's just all so evil, and so empty, that there's nothing that he wants. That Lou's only understanding of success is money, near as I can tell. Lou does not have any. Lou seems like a man of few pleasures. goes after Rene Russo sexually, kind of, for part of the movie. But it seems like Lou just wants to get ahead just for the sake of getting ahead, that it's just this completely arbitrary metric for his own measurement of himself in his own eyes, that there's no end goal at all. There's no other way that he would like to be living, really. It's just that he understands this is what he's supposed to do. This is the metric by which he is to be judged. But he's trying to succeed in that as much as he can. I think the point of this movie can be summed up by saying that Lou Bloom is kind of like I said earlier, that Lou Bloom is not necessarily a person per se. In the sense that we understand the other human beings we interact with to be people, that Lou Bloom is a sort of person shaped byproduct of capitalism, that he is in some sense the absolute ideal actor within the capitalist system. He is the man who can actually embody what that system prescribes for succeeding within it. And that he is only that there is nothing beyond that. And that's what makes him so good. That's why he succeeds. That's what success is the point of the movie, is that under conditions like this, the measure of success is how much you are like Lou Bloom. And however much you are not like Lou Bloom, however much you have anything, any kind of counterweight to this pure furthering of your own standing with no regard to anything else, that to whatever extent you are not like that, then you are held back, that the system punishes that, but it punishes you the less you are like Lou Bloom, and rewards you for being Lou Bloom, and Lou is just rewarded more and more throughout the movie. It's a success story, because that is what success entails, and that the movie just really just puts that out there and puts it in your face. It says, this is the guy. This is the dream. This is the guy that you would have to be to really succeed at the dream. Is to be like this. But this is what they say you should be like. This is the natural end state of it. Because he couldn't exist in any other circumstance. In an older world, in an older social order of any kind, Lou would be too off-putting to get anywhere. You kind of see that at the outset of the movie with him trying to get the job at the junkyard, which we'll get into in just a sec, so I won't go too into it. But it seems very clear that without this this foot in the door of being really good at something awful that other people pay people to do so they don't have to, and being able to walk in with a result, with something that he did with that skill set, and being able to sell it right off the bat, that without that, without a context in which he could do that, everybody would have one conversation with Lou Bloom and immediately recognize that there was something very, very off about this guy and that they wanted to get away from him as quickly as possible. And he would get nowhere. He would be an outcast, as he is at the start of this movie. He's clearly this wretched figure. Just skulking around through the night, committing petty crime mostly is what it looks like. Yeah. So, yeah, again, and that's why I say that, like, the key to this, this character's uniqueness, the movie's uniqueness, is not just the character itself, but the environment he exists in. That the fact that there is an environment, which specifically in this, yeah, is local news. But again, I think there are broader things than that are implicated by the story of this movie. That the point is that there are environments now, in which not only can a person, you know, person, so to speak, like Lou, not only can they thrive, it's set up for them to thrive. They are the ideal the agents within this system, in at least certain circumstances, within the larger environment that we exist in.
Yeah. Did you enjoy the way that Lou only speaks in this weird hybrid of, like, corporate seminar / self-help actualization vocabulary?
It's so weird because, like, he's not, like, completely off in his delivery, you know? It's not really the way he speaks so much as what he says and what he doesn't say, and just the way that he conducts himself. Yeah, that he's just always talking in these completely empty self-help business wisdom platitudes, and is selling them. He knows how you're supposed to say this stuff. He's heard other people say them. He is probably, given the creature that he is, just copying the inflection that he heard somebody else say them with as closely as possible. You know, we see him practicing laughing on his own in his home at one point. The delivery is not terrible in every instance. It's just that, yeah, that's all that he can say. That it's the only thing that he thinks anybody wants to hear, that all that they want out of him is to know that he has such a good attitude, and has, you know, all of the attitudes that you're supposed to have to succeed in this world, and that just assuring people that you know the first thing that we see him do in the movie, well, not quite the first thing, but one of the first things we see him do is sort of attempt to give himself a job interview, that he's before somebody who he thinks might employ him, and he immediately starts auditioning for that employment. But you very quickly get the sense that that's just how he treats everybody, that he can only talk to people, because he sees every interaction as transactional. He has no interest in people outside of what he can get out of them. And is approaching everything that way, but that, like, he's auditioning for a job interview. Like, all that he has to do is just sell this person on how it would absolutely be mutually beneficial for you to give me what I want, but that you want to do this, but just, you know, selling them on it, just making the hard sell every time, and that is the only way that he can think to approach interacting with anybody. Because that's all that he knows how to do, and that's all that he wants to do.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating the way that Lou is always trying to negotiate on behalf of himself, but there is nothing he hates more than someone else negotiating with him on behalf of their self.
Yeah, funny thing that, isn't it? That when he's on the other side, when he's trying to get hired, that he wants to negotiate as much for himself as he can. But then when somebody else is in that position, doesn't give a shit. He will pay that person as little as possible for as long as possible. But yeah, we'll never give an inch. It's almost as if that is what is rationally, logically incentivized by whichever side of that divide that you're on, if you're the employee, you want to get paid as much as possible, and if you're the employer, you want to pay as little as possible. That the only reason every boss does not conduct himself the way that Lou Bloom conducts himself towards his employees is because most of them have at least a bit of a bit more vestige of humanity than he does. That there is some kind of memory there, some kind of human sympathy, of knowing what it's like to be on that side. And okay, maybe, you know, I won't only do the very minimum that I can get away with for them. You know, maybe I won't pay them the absolute minimum that I could get away with. But that is what's incentivized. That is an irrational choice within the system. And Lou is not in the business of making choices that are irrational from the perspective of his own self-interest. Does not perceive any reason why he might ever do that. So, yeah. I keep going off with everything you say. I really enjoyed this movie. I had many thoughts.
I am glad you did. Do you find it a great Pride Month movie?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Just the vibes are immaculate in this movie, aren't they? I mean, it is a woke movie. It is more woke even than I was expecting, because it is not only, again, I think, implicitly really anti-capitalist, but the racial politics of the addiction to sensationalist 24-hour news on the part of affluent white America is a central theme in this movie. It is brought up very often and very explicitly. What the relationship between this media and the culture that it entertains, so to speak. Exactly what that is, and it is very upfront with it. I was very surprised by that. I feel like the kind of discourse on that subject specifically that you see a little bit of in this movie was still not as widespread in popular culture when this movie came out. It was 2014.
Yeah,
you know, Obama was still president when this movie came out. So. I was surprised by that. There is nothing particularly gay in this movie, no. I think that it is a movie that shares a lot of common cause, but with the gay community and with the gay rights movement. It's not really like the most insane thing that we could pick for our Pride Month special episode. It's a little counterintuitive, but you can see it.
Well, you know what? That is for our boy Jake.
That's true. And again, he is still somehow attractive in this movie still. I'm only like a little bit gay, but Gyllenhaal is very much my type. I can see it. Absolutely. Even in this movie, there's a part of you that wants to hold out hope that this guy could be fixed, but he can't because there is no guy there to fix. He does not exist.
Yeah. Gyllenhaal actually lost 20 pounds to play this role because of the fact that he wanted Lou to look ravenous.
Which he does. His eyes are fucking bugging out of his skull. He looks terrifying in this movie.
Like, there's never like an actual coyote in the film, but there's a lot of coyote imagery. And like, the idea was that they wanted to make Lou look as much like a coyote as possible, which meant that he had to be very thin and sort of aggressive looking, hard. For Jake to
pointy. He's a very angular looking fellow.
Yeah.
He's just this weird, creepy little goblin man dressed up as a regular guy, saying stuff that he's heard regular guys say, and trying to pretend that he is not some kind of demon.
Yeah. All right. Do you have any other initial thoughts on the film Nightcrawler?
I think that I had my fill of initial thoughts. I gave out lots of initial thoughts just now, and I will have many more thoughts as we go through the story. I think we got to get into it.
Yeah, there's so much to unpack with this movie. Like, again, just the critique of like how bad your local news is.
Yeah, it's, and just, it's just so pointed. Just everything that this it reminds me of Greener Grass in that sense. That just everything that this movie is disgusted with. It is so pointed and focused, but in sharing its revulsion for those elements of the world with you. It is just such a just such a tight piece of satire, I think. It's so good. And there's so much packed into it. There's such density of theming.
Yeah. All right. So the movie opens and we meet Lou, who at the time we meet him is stealing scrap metal from an LA rail yard.
Yeah, before we see him, we see his bolt cutters. I'm cutting through a fence that he probably shouldn't be going through.
Yeah. Like, it's some very on-the-news symbolism about the kind of person that he is. That he is someone who will not let a fence keep him out.
Yeah, yeah. When Lou comes to a fence that says you're not supposed to go through it, the thing that he does is go and get some bolt cutters.
Yeah. But he is stopped by a security guard, and Lou sees that the security guard has, like, a nice watch, and so attacks him and steals the watch along with all the other scrap metal that he was carrying around or trying to.
And probably does kill him, right? We don't see that guy again in the movie. Is this movie PG-13? I was thinking that it might have been while I was watching it, but I could not tell outright.
I feel like it was rated R, but like it would be a. I feel like it was rated R, but
I feel like it is cautious with the level of violence that it shows, and obviously that is an element in the movie, and I thought that that might have been maybe part of the motivating factor for making the movie, was that you could make a movie that was very thematically dark, but not necessarily very graphic, if it revolved around settings in which there was reason to limit the graphicness of what was shown.
Yeah, it was an R rating.
Okay. But at any rate, we do not see the murder of the security guard, but it seems logical to assume so. And that is, depending on your definition, the only person that Lou personally kills in the movie. And so that's just there. That's just hanging over him in the background for the whole movie. Lou knows that he's a murderer. Lou is having every interaction with the recent memory of killing a guy for his watch and to not get in trouble for stealing shit, which he did without a second thought. And nobody else knows this, and it doesn't, except for one guy. But that information is not really immediately relevant for anybody, but it's there. It is put right on the table. What kind of guy this is, what kind of person, so to speak, this story is about. Which I think was a good choice, because I don't think that Lou Bloom is a character that you want to gradually get a sense of, you know? Because, again, there's nothing there. You don't get to know Lou any better than you do at the start of the movie. Over the course of the movie, because there's nothing there. There's a cold, steely mechanism of self-interest, and that's it. So I don't think that the movie would play really well if you didn't have him do something really, really awful right at the outset and just slowly watched him work up to the awful stuff he does by the end. That I feel like that wouldn't play really well, because you would be wanting to get insight, and you would be wanting to wonder how far he would go, and all this other stuff. And so knowing that he has absolutely no limits at all right from the outset, I think is good storytelling for how this character is presented to us. And it lets you know the kind of movie that this is, but that this is still our main character. And again, the movie kind of satirically seems to be rooting for him a lot of the time, But that when things go well for Lou, the movie treats it like things going well for its hero, and the music swells and the shot lingers on his face, and you can tell that he's thinking, yes, this is what I have to do. I know what I have to do now. But you always know that we are looking at these moments being applied to somebody who has no shred of decency in them whatsoever.
Yeah. But Lou then takes all of his stolen goods to a scrapyard, where he first tries to negotiate for a higher price for them, and then he tries to get himself a job, and the foreman's like, no. The foreman basically immediately realizes that all the metal is stolen, and finds Lou off-putting and horrible.
Yeah, well, and he says, again, after Lou gives him some of his shit, that he says, I don't hire thieves. And that there is the key, because Lou did not think of that. That Lou is in that moment just, again, totally focused on being whatever this guy wants him to be so that he will hire him, and thinks clearly that this is possible. That Lou does not see this as unrealistic or as a bad play to go for at all. But thinks that he's done this guy service, but he's getting paid to do a job. He did the job, did it well. So I should have more consistent employment here. I should be able to pitch that. He needs me. And it just does not occur to him that the entire way that this business interaction went screams sketchiness. Having that little freelance interaction with Lou Bloom would not make you inclined to hire him at all. But he cannot really put himself in the other guy's shoes to that extent. But cannot really imagine how he is really coming off to this guy. But as soon as he realizes he has nothing, he has no shot here, just immediately shrugs it off. It gives his fake smile and his fake laugh and just leaves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But on his way home, he sees a car crash and is introduced to the people filming it for the local news. Who basically tell him like a brief overview of that job, being a stringer, and how it's all about like getting as much as you can out of the worst the worst tragedies possible. Eventually, one of the more bizarre and chilly moments in this film is when he's being interviewed by the police and he says, well, I always say that if you see me, you're having the worst day of your life. The complete lack of any kind of compassion for other human beings.
Yeah, again, he's making that as a joke. He's like chuckling a little bit as he says that, because he thinks that the other person might find that funny.
So he gets introduced to the concept of being a stringer, and so his big idea is that he goes out and he steals a bicycle, which he exchanges at a pawn shop for a police scanner and a camcorder.
After trying to way upsell it, and making all kinds of bullshit claims that it has 37 gears, and the guy is like, no bike has 37 gears. And then he just immediately drops it. He says, all right, well, what if I give it to you for store credit?
So he goes out and he tries to get some good footage. And, like, the thing is that he doesn't get a lot of good footage. Like, he's... When we're first introduced to this aspect of the film, like, he keeps filming, like, extremely petty police interactions. Like, some woman getting a breathalyzer test.
Right, yeah.
Which, like, just indicates, like, how, like, to me, that indicates, like, how horrible he is because of the fact that, like, a lot of the later crimes that he films are legitimate news stories. Like, they're not, like, there are multiple people dying, they're, like, they are, they get legitimate, like, if three people get shot in the house, that is a legitimate news story. But, like, here, it's very clearly established that whatever he perceives as legitimate or not legitimate is, like, not, like, he's not justifying his actions by the fact that, oh, yeah, these are real news stories that really do need to be covered.
No, that his whole understanding of it at that point is just bad stuff. It's people pay other people to film bad stuff because people like watching footage of bad stuff. Even says this to Rene Russo later when he's trying to get a better sense of what he should film. He keeps saying, so bloody. And she'll use a couple of euphemisms and talk around it a little bit and add some more details. Okay, but bloody. Graphic. But yes. But yeah, that has no sense at first of why anybody would have interest in this. He does seem to get some kind of sense of that over the course of the movie, of exactly what kind of illicit and graphic and illegal activity people like to see on television, or just police interactions or whatever. People running afoul of the law is his initial understanding, basically. Or disasters too, fires.
It's like I said, is that, like, there is, within him, there is no justification about the fact that, like, okay, well, he's being trashy and exploitative about these, like, horrible crimes, but that they are real news stories that really do need to be covered by the local news.
And in fairness, like, none of the other stringers that we meet in the movie talk that way either.
Yeah. But, like, it is very clearly established that, like, when he perceives that it is just about, like, oh, we'll film, like, crime and police interactions, that, like, he has no problem filming, like, someone that gets pulled over and is giving a breathalyzer test, which is, like, clearly not actual news. Like, it's just... a person having a bad day.
But again, because at that point, Lou doesn't know why people watch the news. Lou doesn't know why anybody would care about a house break-in where three people were killed. He wasn't killed. Lou probably never watched the news at all before the plot line of this movie started.
Yeah.
He is totally divorced from any of the social concerns that keep people hooked to the news. And so, yeah, again, at the start is just shooting in the dark, has no idea what people might pay him so that they can put it on the news, because he doesn't know why people watch the news. But he learns. He learns that they watch it because they're white and like to be afraid of urban crime creeping into their suburbs. It is amazing how much of the movie is about that idea specifically.
it's actually... One of the best moments in the entire film is when Nina, or Rene Russo's character, she finds out that the biggest set piece in this entire movie is this house robbery. And then she finds out that the house was actually like a drug house and that it wasn't an example of like innocent upper class suburbanites. Were horrified, yeah, exactly. or were were murdered by inner city violence, that they were the inner city violence themselves. And she just, she's like, oh, well, that's not good for the story, so I'm not going to run it.
Yeah, we'll cover that at noon. But that detracts from the story right now in the morning.
Yeah. But anyways, so his first couple of attempts are a bust, but then he finds the aftermath of a carjacking, and the big difference between Lou and the other stringers is that Lou just straight up, like, he gets right up into the carjacking and, like, is filming or truly horrible state at which the guy being pulled out by the paramedics is, like, way more invasive than any of the other stringers, who, again, are all terrible people, like, doing a terrible job.
Yeah, so it's not... It's not exactly that Lou is, like, less squeamish. It's not that he's, like, crazy, so, you know, getting, you know, all up in really awful business with, you know, gore or charred bodies or whatever, just it doesn't bother him, because it clearly doesn't bother the other stringers either. You know, it almost looks, and this is weird for a character who is so purely defined by self-interest, but it feels like this sort of lesser regard for his personal safety. But then the other stringers have,
yeah.
You know, which I guess is sort of the weird other side of his transactional worldview, that, he knows that people pay for good footage. And so, he's going to get it, and is not going to think about whether, you know, he's going to have all his toes tomorrow when he goes out to shoot again, because he doesn't need his toes for shooting footage. You know, so it again, just because Lou has no life outside of this work, because there's nothing else that Lou lives for, that even though he's clearly, is not really self-destructive at all. He's this sort of pure self-interested self-preservationist, that there's still that it comes easier to him, it seems, to risk his life because he doesn't really have a life to risk, that there's only the job, and so he can just keep doing the job, but to the greatest extent that he can, that's just kind of all that's going through his head, it seems like.
Lou is extremely confident in a way that normally, like, in a normal narrative, you are expecting that person to get their comeuppance, which, again, is not something that happens at all in this movie.
No, he's really good at what he does.
Yeah. Like, when he... One of the big things that happens throughout this entire movie is that he is always speeding, like, and driving horribly recklessly.
Yeah.
And yeah. Again, you would expect that, like, in a normal movie, that would be, he would be the one to get into a car crash, which never happens. Like, yeah, he's just extremely confident that whatever situation he is in, he can get out of. And at no point does the movie ever, like, at no point does the movie disabuse you of that notion that whatever situation he gets in, he can get out of.
And again, I think that's the heart of the movie's satire, because again, he's doing the right thing, but he's doing exactly what you do get rewarded for.
But so he takes his footage to KWLA, which is the lowest rated news program in LA. And he meets Nina, who is the news producer, news director. And he sells his first news package. And then Nina gives him, like, the rundown of what they want.
And Nina, right from the get-go, does clearly seem to respond to him positively in a sincere way. That she does get weird vibes from him, but at this point and throughout the movie, but I don't know. It's she's the first character who doesn't who interacts with Lou, who doesn't just respond in that immediate sort of, you know, recoiling from the reptile in a way. And which it kind of gives you some insight into her character and what the part of the local news world that she represents is all about too. That not only is Lou and the footage that he brings, despite how awful it is and how awful he is, that not only are these very useful things to have access to, and is it very useful and potentially profitable for her to have a relationship with Lou, but from the get-go, she seems kind of fascinated by him. That she does seem to genuinely admire Lou in a couple of ways. There's a point later in the movie where she says, I think that Lou should be inspiring all of us to reach a little higher. And it really sounds like she means it. Even though, again, she is hearing the same shit that we are, and does but point out to Lou a couple of times, but how bizarre he is behaving and speaking. But seems to maybe think that he's some kind of savant genius, which in a sense he is, which again just tells you that sad as it is, and this would be the other kind of key point in the movie, and it's why Mina is one of the only two other really realized characters in the movie besides Lou, that even though she clearly is some kind of human being still and does feel things and respond to things like a human, that the world that she exists in, the incentive structure that she exists in, leads her to have a very, very similar value system to what Lou operates under. And so she cannot help but admire the purity of his commitment to those values, but that he is trying to do the same stuff that she does, and his commitment to it is incredible, and that she just cannot help but admire this, even though it is the very fact that makes him a monster, that seems to make him kind of attractive to her in certain senses or moments. There's so much to that. There's so much to building the story around their relationship and to the horror and the simultaneous sort of hilarious irony of the whole thing. It's just such an audacious thing to do. The way that their relationship plays out, and the fact that this movie is structured around their relationship and the way that it plays out, it just feels so outrageous in so many ways. You're being presented with such an ugly thing, as though it is not ugly, as though you really ought to be finding it very admirable and touching. And demanding of you what good reason you have for not responding that way. There's something so punk rock about this movie. It feels like a lot of my favorite satirical movies, like Sorry to Bother You. A movie named after how in the face of its audience it is trying to get at. And I feel like I get a little bit of that from this movie too. But that this movie is, and this would be why I think it that still comfortably fits under the banner of this podcast, that it is trying to actively discomfort the audience as much as possible. But it is on a campaign of giving them the creepy crawlies, but with what they're looking at. And it succeeds in that so well.
Yeah. The big thing for me is that Nina and Lou are of a kind.
Yeah.
Like, Nina is nowhere near as far gone as Lou, but she's the same kind of person. Like, the newsroom very purposefully has like, I don't even know what his job is, but there's this one guy who just basically argues about how unethical everything Lou does, and by extension Nina does, for airing Lou's packages.
He's like Paul Giamatti's character in The Truman Show. And his job is to react like a human being to the insane shit that Christoph says. Ed Harris.
Yeah. Like, that's his role in the film. And her role is to tell him to fuck off and that she's going to do it anyway.
Yeah, but the ratings, man.
Like, and we find out that we don't ever really find out what her deal is, but we do know that she's at least traditionally not very good at her job, because she keeps getting fired.
And the station is not doing so well, and that seems to be her fault in part.
Yeah. Like, she signs these 2-year contracts. Apparently, she fulfills them. She works the full 2 years, and then she's never rehired.
Yeah, never renews them, after.
So, like, there's obviously a string of... there's obviously, like, a string of career missteps, I guess you'd say, behind her, that resulted in her working at the worst news shift at the worst station in LA, which, I mean, LA is huge, though.
So. Yeah. Which we can assume is also the case for Lou. You got to figure that Lou never held down a job even close to as long as this one.
Yeah. But yeah,
that's just like another parallel drawn between them.
Yeah. Like, she has a lot more obvious motivations for behaving this way. Like, Lou's motivations are kind of solely about the money.
And again, not for spending it on anything, and not even really for impressing anybody else, being the other traditional motivator for getting rich. That Lou cannot comprehend any more abstract system of betterment, like metric of betterment, than just increasing his own monetary value.
Yeah. So Nina has like better motivation because the movie presents this as like really her last opportunity, and she is on her way to bungling it until Lou comes along. So she is a lot more, I don't know if the word sympathetic is correct, like the word I actually want to go for is desperate. But whatever is inside a normal person that would be like, no, this way crosses all ethical and moral lines, she just does not have.
Well, and she becomes more like Lou over the course of the movie, I think. It seems like there is, maybe there is a little bit of humanity in there still, and maybe that is what kept getting her fired. You know, the capacity for the human error that just comes from a lack of total commitment, just from the fact that people, full-rounded human beings, have other stuff going on in their lives and so cannot usually perfectly commit themselves to whatever it is that they get paid to do for a living. But that just being human means that you have something going on outside of that. That it is the very lack of that quality that allows Lou to succeed so extraordinarily and so quickly in this field. And that she can sense that. And that she is, just far gone and awful enough of a still human being at this point in her life to recognize that, and for that to be the way that she responds. But then again, this is a bad person meeting a not person and thinking, oh man, that's what I gotta be. That's what's holding me back. that really does feel like the dynamic. Like, she finds the fact that he has purged himself of the shred of humanity that has been holding her back inspiring and aspirational.
Yeah.
You know, holy shit! Again, that is the main relationship that this movie is built around. and that's just laying it out. I think it just varied, like, you know, plain matter of fact terms. Like, that is the text of this movie. And it is so horrifying. And in such an out there way that it's not just like a bad thing happening to good people. It's like the whole premise for the story is just built upon this complete lack of human value in the way that we typically understand it. You know, it's crazy. It's crazy to me that those characters' relationship is the main arc of this movie in a way, like the emotional core of the movie, so to speak.
So were you shipping Nina Liu?
I think they deserve each other. Yeah. I'm sure they'll be very happy together.
But Nina lays out the philosophy of the news, which is that what they want, they don't care about crime. What they want is for affluent middle-class white people being the victims of crime by minorities.
Yeah, it's so explicit.
Like, she says that directly. Like, a crime that happens to a black person is not worth covering. Like,
well, and doesn't she note that this is specifically because of the decline in crime, that there is no longer such quantity of crime that you can you know, instill the paranoid, you know, NIMBY terror that news is built around catering to, that you can no longer sustain that just by reporting on the sheer quantity of crime, because if you did, then you would be giving the impression that the city is becoming safer and safer, and that is not what you want to be telling your news viewers. So, specifically the kind of crime that will maintain that paranoid, glued to the news feeling. But again, like, the fact that is so central to this movie, and that this movie came out in 2014 is crazy to me. That this is just diagnosing the illness that America was already dying of at that point in time, and which has become so much more obvious now. But that there is this whole media landscape and environment that is built around catering to people's activating emotions and not towards giving them an accurate impression of reality. The fact that we are entering into that circumstance, into this point where, you know, the media is having to say, well, America isn't really as scary as it used to be. How do we maintain the scary? How do we keep our viewers scared so that they keep watching the news? That it is right as society is drifting into a point where that becomes a major driver of the news industry and how it operates, that you find the story of the success of Lou Bloom and of him being the salvation of someone like Mina. It's like the fucking Long Halloween. It's like the way that in Long Halloween you see the old world of the mob giving way to the world of the super criminals that Batman has to deal with. And that Lou is that, or like a No Country for Old Men, obviously, and that Lou is that that next generation breed, that more purely refined version of the evil, and that Mina can only see this, and everything that she represents can only see this as the lifeline that she's been praying for. But this is the man for the time that we're in now. But because there is not as much violent crime out there from poverty, we are now in the business of making the world seem scarier than it actually is, Lou Bloom is the man that we need. But this is the chance meeting in our great journey that has made it possible for us to keep going.
Well, Lou's next big adventure is that he manages to get to the scene of a shoot-up at a house. So it was a suburban house where gunmen shot through the window. And as the police are talking to the couples who own the house outside, Lou enters the house and films all their private effects. And in particular, well, he films their mail so they can have the information on who they were. And then in particular, he notices that there are several bullet holes in the refrigerator. And this is the start of what's going to be an ever-increasing pattern with him, is that he rearranges the family photos on the fridge so that they are better arranged in the shot around the bullet holes.
Yeah, because Lou is first and foremost a filmmaker. He's just trying to get good footage.
Yeah. And he takes this to Nina, and Nina is ecstatic about it.
Yeah, and the other guy, the guy whose job it is to be the moralizer, immediately says, "No, it looks voyeuristic. It looks like you snuck in there."
Yeah. But now that he's getting better at his job, he can improve his equipment. He buys a new car, and he starts staging war scenes, where he'll like move a dead body.
By this point he's hired Rick, right?
I don't know. Like, I was just getting to the point where he hires Rick.
Okay.
So like he needs to hire someone to be like both a second camera operator and to operate MapQuest for him. Because Lou does not have a smartphone. I forget if smartphones were common at this particular point in time.
I think they already were. I think they were fairly omnipresent by 2014. So Lou would be weird for not having one.
Yeah, but he doesn't have a phone that gives him directions on it. Or at least one that he can like easily follow. And Rick... So he sets out an advertisement and he winds up meeting with this homeless guy who he asks the most inappropriate questions possible about before offering him a free internship. Like, Lou is straight up a Ferengi.
Yeah, and again, just... It's a ridiculous thing to even propose at that point. But again, all that is going through his mind is, what are the acceptable ways within the system that I'm operating in to part with as little money as possible? And he gets negotiated out of that almost immediately. Again, this is the thing, is that he's willing to do that. But doesn't actually want to talk to a whole bunch of people, it seems like. Doesn't care what this guy said in answer to any of the questions, it sounds like. It seems like he was going to go with whoever the first person desperate enough for the job to take as little as he was willing to offer would be. That there was nothing in particular that he was looking for in his employee, other than that sufficient level of desperation. Initially proposes it as, how about you do this work for me? This incredibly dangerous, as we very quickly find out, this incredibly dangerous and stressful work for free. And the guy's like, no, and says, okay, how about $30 a night? So would rather not do the $30 a night, but was always prepared to do that. but wanted to see if he could get away with just not paying him at all for doing this. That is just Lou's approach in a nutshell, that the very, very least he can possibly give up while still potentially getting what he wants out of something, that is always his first plan.
Yeah. Which Rick is the most sympathetic of our three main characters, but
you feel a little bad for the guy. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of his story is about how he is corrupted by Lou. But like, no matter how bad Rick gets it, you still always feel bad for it because of the fact that Lou is so clearly taking advantage of him.
Like, he's the Jesse Pinkman of the movie, not a great guy either, really. He does some very bad stuff. You still kind of want him to make it out of this while suspecting that he probably won't.
Yeah. And and Rick has the worst circumstances out of anyone in this film in that he is homeless. So he doesn't have like another real option than this job.
And like the other two, we don't really dive all that much into his situation and into where he's coming from. Again, those are the only two big characters besides Lou, really. But there's the other stringer we run into a couple times, but it's mostly Lou and Rick and Nina. And yep. Those two we only ever see when they interact with Lou. So again, it is really Lou that is the center of the movie by a big margin. But I as is the case with the two of them, the point of it seems to be that it doesn't matter. Lou points out to him at some point, he's trying to negotiate a raise, Lou just points out to him, you're not in a position to do that. But you do not have any leverage over me because of your situation. Again, just very, very plainly, sort of jokingly saying this, as if it isn't an awful thing to say to somebody. And that is all that you really need to know about Rick, and that is the point that Rick's presence in the movie makes, is that, yeah, you can always find those people. But the Lous of the world will always be able to find assistance. Because there will be people that are desperate enough to take the very least that they're willing to dish out for the very worst stuff imaginable.
Then Lou more or less blackmails Nina into a date. Because Nina becomes... She's entirely reliant upon Lou's, let's call it, unique approach to doing the job of a stringer. And he threatens to jump to another station if she doesn't go on a date with him.
And again, lest we not make it clear, that means that Lou getting into this game is saving this station. This station would be going under were it not for Lou deciding to do this job and do it the way that only he can.
Yeah. And we find out that later on, we find out that at some point Nina told him no on some sort of sexual situation. And Lou did not take that well.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was gonna say, and then he basically blackmails her into never saying no to him again ever.
Yeah, and at the end of that date, they have that one of my favorite exchanges in the movie, which is that Lou is saying to her, he's like, I want you. And she says that you want me to fuck you. And he says that Anna's a friend. And she looks at him and this is one of the only times that she really reacts like a regular person to Lou, that she said, Jesus Christ, Lou, your friends do not blackmail each other into sleeping with you. And Lou, again, perfectly calm, perfectly unflappable. This is one of my favorite lines in the movie. He says, Well, see, actually, that's not true, Amina, because a friend, as I'm sure you know, is a gift you give yourself.
I mean, he definitely gave Nina to himself.
Exactly. And that is just the one of the like main points of this movie, I think, is not just that a sociopath could get by on just saying like empty corporate speak things, but that beyond that, going through lots of empty standard corporate speak platitudes, you realize that almost all of them are things that a psychopath would say, that you're kind of building the vocabulary of somebody like that just in compiling those already. So, yeah, it would make sense that somebody like that might just, you know, have an encyclopedic infinite reference to those instead of a real personality.
Lou gets offered to work with a guy named Joe, who's another stringer who works for or who owns a company called Mayhem, who Joe is attempting to get multiple cars running throughout LA so that they can hit every story and not compete with each other. And he wants Lou to run the second car.
Yeah, because they've run into each other a couple of times. He gave Lou pointers, helped Lou get started in this industry, which becomes ironic very much in just a little bit here.
Which Lou wants to work for himself. And they have a tierce confrontation about it. And then there's a plane that crashes into Los Angeles, and all the people on the board the plane die. And Lou is beat to it by Joe. So Nina doesn't have the story and berates him for being bad at his job, basically. And I forget what exactly it is that he says about that, but it's like something like, I always endeavor to be better than the day before, or something like that.
Yeah. And then he has like his only change in demeanor at all in the movie. He's really frustrated back at his home, and he smashes his mirror and screams into it. And that is the only time we see him behave any differently in the whole course of the movie. The possibility of failing in this is genuinely excruciating to him. It seems like it's like the only real emotion that we can like for sure pin on him in this whole movie.
It is the only time that he really does show an actual emotion that's not just like a show for whoever he's talking to. And even that he's not very good at. So in the aftermath of this failure, Lou and Rick, the movie explicitly says that they're pretty far out. They're in like the really rich people inner cities or inner ring suburbs of Los Angeles. And they get a report over the radio of a triple homicide home invasion. Although maybe I think it might just be that they get a report that the alarm is going off at this particular residence.
They definitely get there before the police in any regard. And Lou doesn't really know the extent of the situation coming into it.
Yeah. Lou hides in the bushes and he films the gunman leaving the house, including their license plate. And then he enters the house and finds a bloodbath with three homicide victims. And like literally just wanders the entire house trying to find every single thing that he could film. There is a nursery in the home. And you get the sense that Lou is extremely disappointed that there is not a murdered baby in that nursery.
But Amina loves it, loves that you can build up the tension of wondering whether there's a baby in there, and gets the news anchors to build it up in the same way when they're showing it on the air and let the viewers wonder for a second whether there's going to be. Yeah. It's so, just so utterly despicable at every level. It's so good.
Yeah. So he gets everything, like close-ups of these dead bodies, all the signs of violence in the house, and then he purposefully withholds it from Nina until like 10 minutes before they're about to air. Like it's an absurdly close time. And he wants a ridiculous amount of money for it. Nina says it's like the budget for the entire month is being spent on this footage, but she agrees to it.
Well, Lou knows that you need leverage when you're negotiating for a raise, and he has leverage.
Yeah.
And again, and that it's just purely that simple. That this is a horrible, horrible thing to do to this person who is, as much as anybody else, the reason why he's succeeding. Is because he met this person and formed a good business relationship with them, whatever else their relationship is. And, like, yeah, without this person, without encountering this person, without lucking into encountering this person, could very well not be succeeding in this thing, but is perfectly happy to use as much leverage as he has to get as much out of her as possible. Will not think twice about this even remotely.
Yeah. It's very dark. And they decide that they're going to just air the footage with blurring. Like, and it's all the worst blurring that you've ever seen.
They have, like, the legal liaison in there. They're trying to figure out what they can legally get away with showing. Like, how graphic can we push it?
Yeah, the only thing that Lou edits out himself is that he cuts out the gunman.
Uh-huh.
And this will be part of his big plan for solving all his problems in one fell swoop.
In three easy steps.
Yeah.
This one simple trick professionals hate.
But Lou also demands that he be credited directly by the anchors. He also wants to meet like the entire like management of the entire station, the owner, the director of the whole station.
Yeah, and that means that when we're... And that means that when the segment is on the air and we're watching it, and you're getting this horrific footage, all of this horrible imagery and the ugliness of how it is being presented, and that the whole time Lou is just standing there at the back watching, just beaming, just smiling away. It's like they said my name. They said the name of my company on TV. They have the logo on TV. I'm making it. It's all coming up. It's all coming up bloom, so to speak.
Yeah, I really wonder if he has, at this point, a proper LLC with a business license and everything.
I'm sure by the end of the movie he does.
Yeah. But yeah. Several detectives show up at Lou's apartment and question him about the events of the home invasion, and he gives them the edited footage, claiming that it is all the footage that he took. Also, one of the other things that he does is he sabotages Joe from Mayhem's van, causing it to crash and severely injure him.
Yeah, and Joe is not quite dead when he's filming his body. He looks up and sees him, and he can't get anything out. His throat is all full of blood, but it seems so obvious that he knows what happened, that he knows that he is looking up at the man who killed him and who is now going to profit from his death in the way that he taught him how to do. And we just linger on that irony for a moment, and it just moves on. This movie is just so brutal in such a unique way. I can't get over it. There is just this brutal black comedy, blacker than tar comedy, that just it just makes everything that much more horrific, because it is always horrific in a deeply ironic way. It's so good.
Yeah. Yeah. So Lou, since he knows the license plate, is able to track the license plate to where the two presumably gunmen are hanging out. He and Rick head there, and Rick realizes what fucked up shit is about to go down. And Lou has been claiming that he can't give Rick a raise because of the fact that he needs to give Rick a performance review beforehand. And suddenly the fact that, I think that at this point, it's just that, Rick knows that Lou did not give the police the full story about what happened that night. So Lou distracts Rick by giving him a really good performance review, just like on the spot, and offering him a raise, which Rick, like, he doesn't, this is a really dick move, but he doesn't like give Rick a specific number. That's like,
here. Yeah, he tells him to pick one, and he goes for it at 75, and then immediately thinks better of it. He's, I could have gotten more, couldn't I? And Lou goes, yep.
Yeah. No, it's a really shitty tactic, because of the fact that, like, it tricks Rick into severely underselling his own, like, his own job.
Well, Lou, of the fact that
he's afraid of going.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, like, Rick undersells his own job because of the fact that he's afraid that if he goes too high, it will offend Lou. And so he accidentally goes way lower than Lou would have agreed. And, like,
yeah,
as opposed to if Lou had offered the number, then that would be the baseline that Rick would start to negotiate for. Like, and again, while Lou loves to negotiate on behalf of himself, he does not want anyone else negotiate on their behalf.
No.
Like, that becomes like a core element of his relationship with Nina, is that Nina can't advocate for herself, even though she's the one that's like technically in the position.
Right, and that's the thing, though, is that that Rick doesn't even have that advantage going for him. That Rick is the one guy that Lou directly has power over. You know, he has leverage with Mina and with the station, and with other people. But that Rick is so completely dependent upon him, and so beholden to his every whim. You know, in the course of working for him, and so Lou, I think, comes the closest with Rick to displaying something like actual sadism. That it does kind of seem like Rick knows that he is, or that Lou knows that he is tormenting Rick, because he clearly has no real opinion of him or his performance at all. That every time he talks to him about how he's doing, he starts off with some positive reinforcement and then negs him, because that's just what he heard you should do. You know, that you have to give him a little bit of positive reinforcement, but a little bit of criticism to keep him on his toes, feel like he has to improve. And so that's what he gives him every time, but has made no evaluation of how good of a job he's doing. Because that's sort of immaterial. You know, he's doing the job good enough that Lou can keep making money. You know, and he's not going to go to the trouble of finding somebody else if he doesn't have to. I think that he knows that that Lou is not quite so alienated from the human experience that he does not understand what a horrible limbo state he is keeping this poor kid in. And it seems like, to me at least, that it's not just that he's that doing that in the transactional way that he does everything else. That I think that he enjoys exercising that power over Rick. And again, kind of relishes but in the way that that negotiation goes. That when Rick is like, I could have gotten more. Yes, absolutely. Well, can I have more? No, the negotiation is closed. You know, and that he's just kind of the cat who ate the canary in that moment. He's, I put him in his place.
Yeah.
And it is Rick who gives him the most extended kind of dressing down of his behavior. I think kind of as we enter into this sequence of them following the gunman, but that he's like, you know, you got to let people in a little bit, Lou. You got to talk to them like human beings, because, you know, your attitude and the way you look at things is really weird. Like, you know that, right? You know, your problem is that you just don't understand people. And that proves to be important. There is an echo of that line later, which is very a key to the whole movie. And that is what we are given by the only character who seems to be interested in figuring out what is wrong with Lou Bloom. That is his pronouncement on it, is that you just don't understand people.
Yeah. But Lou takes them to where the car is being stored. And they do a takeout. And Rick realizes the fact that that in much the same way that he's been staging crime scenes throughout the movie, Lou is staging an encounter with the police. That he's going to wait for these two gunmen to be in a public area, call the police, and like basically prompt a shootout.
Well, he wants to wait until they're in a nice neighborhood, but they end up going to a restaurant. And he's like, all right, we work with what we get. But yeah, wanted them to go to a white upper middle class neighborhood and have them get arrested there.
Yeah. But so Rick, he essentially, or like, he determines that, yeah, Rick decides that he is now not comfortable with this entire situation.
Well, realize and that so, what Lou is doing is illegal, and so can actually negotiate with some leverage. Can say, hey, if there's a reward for catching these guys, it's $50,000. I want half of that because I'm doing half the work, and if you don't give me half, then I'm gonna tell the cops that you withheld this information for your fucking story. And Lou says, do you know that I have never cursed in front of an employer?
So. He negotiates for half of what they make that night, which that does not sit well with Lou.
Yeah, that man's life was kind of over when he did that.
But anyways, they follow the gunman to a Chinese restaurant, and then Lou calls the police on the gunman. Lou calls the police on the gunman, and the police show up. Four police officers show up. There is a shootout.
It's a pretty crazy shootout. The one guy gets like shot through the window. There are definitely some customers that get shot by the gunman. But there's an officer down.
Yeah, we're told pretty explicitly that people die in the shootout. But yeah, so it's a big deal. And then one of the gunmen is killed in this shootout, along with, I believe, a customer, and then several police officers are in critical condition. And then begins like one hell of a car chase. Because
it's an insane car chase. This is one of the best ones I've seen in a while.
Yeah, because the gunman leaves in his SUV, he's followed by the police, and then Lou follows them, with Rick filming the entire time.
Yeah, and winds up in front of the gunman at certain points, because of like detours that they did. They're all jumbled together on the road because they're all swerving around everywhere. The gunman is driving very erratically, and so everybody else is trying to match him. So Lou is just right there in the Lou and Rick are there in the thick of it. With this, you know, sort of bundle of police cars and the gunmen just, you know, screaming back and forth across the highway.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. Like, one of the police cars flips over.
Yeah, and Lou goes, "Ooh." It's just like, nice, we got that. Like,
yeah.
You are half expecting in the middle of this car chase for Lou to go, "I like this job. I like it."
Yeah. No, and it's kind of amazing for how like, again, you are expecting Lou to like crash his car. Like, that's the normal karmic thing that any movie would do.
Right. But he's been training for this. He's great at driving fast.
Yeah.
He's had tons of practice.
He is the only one that doesn't crash his car. Like, everyone else involved in the police chase just does. The SUV tips over, it crashes into the police car, it tips over. Lou walks around to film from behind the police car. So he, from where his vantage point, he can see into the SUV. He tells Rick that the gunman is dead and to go film his corpse. Rick runs around. And the gunman
should have been
very
suspicious
much
from the get-go.
Yeah. The gunman is very much alive. Gunman's very much alive and shoots Rick dead. Although Rick is alive just long enough to express the betrayal of Lou.
Who very calmly explains his rationale for doing so. But as Rick is on his way out of this mortal coil, he said, you took away my bargaining power. We're on the other side of the callback to that exchange. But this is the one time that Lou offers any perspective about himself, because he's trying to get Rick to get out of the car to film the restaurant before the shootout begins. There are two police officers that arrive, and then a while later, the other two arrive, and then the shootout starts. So there's this long period of tension for where there are some cops in the restaurant, the gunmen are looking at them, but they're not sure if they're there for them. And he's telling him to, like, go down the street and film it from the side because he needs the angle. He's like, "I'm not fucking getting out of the car. There's a shootout that's about to happen, like, right here. I'm staying here." Lou looks over at him and says, "What if my problem isn't that I don't understand people? What if I don't like them?" Mm-hmm. And then in so many words says, "What if I hurt you if you don't do this physically? What if I threaten physical violence against you? How about you do what I tell you to do then, huh?" The extent to any acknowledgement that we get from Lou of what kind of thing he is. But it is still kind of pointed, I think, because, again, the creepiness of Lou is defined by his attempts to be this likable, regular guy. that he's just always performing that to people. And even though it is all clearly fake, that he is just so committedly and exaggeratedly going through the motions Being somebody who is invested in talking to you, et cetera, et cetera, and so the fact that he is in this moment where it comes down to the wire, where this guy is just is refusing to honor the transaction, is just not doing what Lou wants him to do, and so he will have to fall back on the fundamental kind of leverage, which is always there if you want to call upon it and if you need to, and he. And says and that in that moment of you know, reaching that point, that he says to that person, because he has no reason to pretend anymore at this point, says you know, basically says, hate you, but don't think that that I care at all about what happens to you. Don't think that you can make an appeal involving your humanity to me. That you are behaving as though I don't hate you, and this is incorrect on your part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I do not like people at all. I'm just here to get out of them whatever I can get them to give me. And I can get you to give me this because I can hurt you. So go do it. And that when it comes down to it, that's all that there is for Lou. And that it is all a charade, and he knows it's a charade. But that he is actively pretending to have any interest in these people, all of whom he holds in utter contempt all the time.
Yeah. And then he takes the footage, which again includes Rick's death, gives it to Nina, who is in rapturous awe of it.
It seems like, kind of like turned on by the fact that he filmed his partner's death, and they like almost kiss with the frozen final frame of his dying partner on the screen still.
Yeah. She basically immediately, since the police know who called in the gunman's location, they show up at the news office. And more or less immediately, they want all the footage, and they don't want any of it to air. And they're very upset about the fact that a police officer died, or is in the hospital, about to die. And Nina just goes full pitbull and says, we're going to air it, and they do air it. Eventually, I think Lou is the one that gives the police the footage. But yeah, it's extremely successful, and the impression that I get from the movie is that this whole saga of like the crime, did they call it the murder house?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. Is that this whole saga of the murder house has now made the failing news station the most successful news station in LA.
Yeah, or at least saved it, at least made it a bigger deal.
And like I said, Nina is just, she's in awe of this. Like, she acts as if Lou had just handed her the Sistine Chapel. Like, she looks at that film the way that I look at Paddington 2.
Or Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yes.
And she looks at Jake Gyllenhaal the way that you look at Jake Gyllenhaal, which you shouldn't do in this movie.
You really shouldn't.
He's not Jake Gyllenhaal. It's actually a character that he's playing who is not as likable.
Yeah. But Lou is interrogated by the police, but even though the detective is like pretty much 100% certain that he is bullshit and is lying out of his ass, she has no choice but to basically just let him go. Poor detective. I forget what her name is. Poor detective.
She tried. She tried to stop this thing.
Yeah, and the movie ends with Lou having two vans and hiring a bunch of interns. And, like, everything came up Lou. Just, like, perfectly.
Again, American dream. He's moving up in the world. You know, now he's the big shot. He got further than the guy above him at the time did when he started.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the last line of the movie is, he tells these poor people that he has hired, who he probably will also get killed at some point, maybe on purpose for fucking content. And he tells them, you might be scared or confused sometimes by the things that I say to you or the things that we do together, but I swear to you today, I will never ask you to do anything that I wouldn't do. And that is where we leave off. And Lou is presumably still going up. He maybe does own his own news station by this point in that timeline. I would actually watch that if they made a Nightcrawler 2 that was set 10 years later with him that much further along in his career. That might actually be kind of fun. I could go for that.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be really quite interesting. He's like, I feel like he'd have a podcast now. If he'd complain about vocals a lot.
Uh-huh. Yeah, again, this part of what makes this movie so fascinating to me is that I feel like it really is something that happened to the media industry and to the American culture that it has this relationship with. And that telling the story in this way, again, of the crime rate going down. But news media still remaining focused on this visceral, terror stuff, which is because of 9/11 more than anything else. John Stewart says this, the modern 24 hours news network was built for 9/11 and in response to 9/11. Mm-hmm. In this environment, this moment where it's starting to drift away from reality, we're like, okay, well, there aren't any more 9/11s happening, but we have to keep that level of interest. Then like emanating out of the void, there is this new kind of media figure who knows all about that, knows all about how to put reality far to the side and appeal directly to the sense of terror and disgust, which keeps people watching what you show them and is only interested in doing that. There's no ideology associated with Lou, but really at the end of the day, the kind of ghouls that started coming into media after this point in time, coming into the mid and later 2010s, most of them probably have no sincere commitment to any ideology either, but any more than Lou Bloom does, that it is really just pure sociopathic opportunism for a lot of them, I think. It ends up being associated with ideology, based in that public irrational terror and terror of inner city crime and immigrant crime, specifically encroaching upon their white suburbs. So the ideological bias that accompanies people like Lou suddenly finding that they can thrive in the American media landscape is linked to that culture and that response and catering to that. I think in a lot of ways this movie is chillingly prophetic. It is this story about exactly what was starting to happen and did continue to happen and is still happening in American media and culture broadly.
Yeah. Would you call yourself a Lou hater?
I do not like Lou Bloom, no. I wish that he would fuck off.
Yeah. Like, it is such a great character of something that is destroyed America right now.
Yeah, it's just such a fittingly sort of total evil. This one reason why I like horror fiction and why I've always loved antagonists. I was always one of those kids that loved the villains in the kids' mm-hmm. movies better than the heroes. And it's because I respond really well to really artful examples of making a case for what evil is. You know, the biggest one in pop culture in my lifetime is obviously the Joker, that there is this a collective agreement that the face of evil is the face of the Joker, that the Joker's way of relating to the world encapsulates the capacity for evil within humanity in a way that is really wide in its scope and really compelling. And so this is a little bit more specific, but still, though, that Lou doesn't just feel like some bad guy. Lou feels like the representation of a rot within the heart of this society. That there is a burgeoning capacity developing for cruelty and inhumanity in this environment specifically. Lou Bloom is just the perfect representation of all of that. Lou Reed too, I guess. But he also was a kind of a disaster of a man.
Yeah.
But he could sing. I don't think that Lou Bloom can sing. He doesn't seem like he has the music in him.
So, would you say that this is one of Jake Gyllenhaal's most iconic roles out of the, three Jake Gyllenhaal movies you've seen?
Right, yeah. I think, yeah, actually, I would say this is my favorite of his movies that I've seen. And I do really love Donnie Darko. I haven't seen it in years. And I remember loving October Sky a lot, too. But this, I think, is a great film. I was really riveted to this the whole time. I think it is beautifully shot, too. I think it's an incredible screenplay. It is very much anchored by this performance. Again, I think that this performance works because it's such a good story and such a pointed story for the things that it is discussing. That is what gives the performance an opportunity to shine. I think this is just such a good movie. I was just so excited watching it.
Yeah, I was really glad that you suggested it when I suggested that we do a Jake Gyllenhaal movie, because I have to watch a Jake Gyllenhaal movie all month long.
And I was excited for the opportunity to suggest it, because again, I had been meaning to see this since it came out. It just never gotten around to it, but I always knew that it existed and knew that I wanted to check it out at some point. It absolutely exceeded my expectations. It was so much more and so much better even than I thought it was going to be. I knew more or less what the Jake Gyllenhaal character was, you know, but that was definitely a focal point in the advertising. A positive comment from me on recent movie advertising, I think that the trailers for this were actually pretty good and did effectively convey in a short span of time what kind of character this was, and what the movie was going to be by extension with him being the main character. I had a sense of that. I had a sense of what the character was and the fact that the movie was built around him. Just the story and the way that the story just lets the ugliness of this situation and this character marinate and set in for the audience. I was really just blown away by
it. Yeah, it's a very good film. It's one of my favorite Jake Gyllenhaal movies in general. It's so good at what it does, and he gives such a great performance. I really wish he had gotten some awards love for it, but if he didn't get some awards love for anything or for some of the other stuff he does, he probably wouldn't get it for this.
Well, we already gave Hopkins an Oscar for playing a creepy, crazy guy, so we never need to do that again. We can always give it to the stars in biopics.
Yeah. I don't believe he Yeah, no, he didn't win the Academy Award for Brokeback Mountain, which is something he definitely should have. Like, that's always going to be the Brokeback Mountain losing so many
See, we should have fucking known. We should have known that we were headed in a bad direction when we couldn't even do that.
Yeah. Like, I think that particular Academy Awards has gone down in history as being some of the worst mishandlings by the Academy, and that they didn't give the Academy Award for Best Picture. They gave it to Ang Lee for Brokeback Mountain, but they didn't give it to Best Picture. They didn't give it Best Actor to Heath Ledger. They didn't give Best Supporting Actor to Jake Gyllenhaal. Mm-hmm. It did get Best Adapted Screenplay, but like, I really wish, like, did you sit there and watch the moon go up over the credits?
I don't think that I sat through all of it, no.
Like, it's such a, like, weird and creepy way to end the film.
It is, and yeah, it mirrors the beginning. We didn't talk about the opening of this movie is this really lovely montage of sort of empty Hopper-esque night scenes around L.A. But it's such a good way of easing you into the movie and the environment of it. You know, this is such an L.A. movie, but I don't think that you could set it anywhere else. And I like that as a way of opening it. And then, yeah, the movie just sort of lets Lou go back off into the night and then goes back to contemplating the L.A. night. And now having given you a glimpse of all of the barbarity and awfulness that is contained out there in it.
Mm-hmm. All right. So do you have any final thoughts on Nightcrawler?
I think I got out all my thoughts. I was kind of big picture focused in this episode because I think it's yep. an allegorically heavy film. I think I've said everything that I really think about this movie. I think in a lot of ways it's a pretty direct and straightforward movie thematically in a lot of ways. It's a very lean kind of story. There's not really any subplots going on. It's a very small cast. It is longer than I thought it would be. It's kind of amazing, I think, how long they can sustain it without developing any of the characters besides those main three, really. I don't think that there's really like too many different ways of looking at or reading into this movie or too many different layers to penetrate, but it just really, really works. It really, really succeeds at what it's doing. And it makes this, really, really entertaining. And again, really darkly funny all throughout, but just also kind of, you know, stomach turning, the horrifying movie right through. It's an awesome movie.
All right, let's move on to our final segment. Best death. Who got the best death in this movie?
Got to be Rick, right?
Yeah, it's Rick. Poor Rick. I liked Rick.
The gunman's death right after is also pretty spectacular, because you see him get shot by the police to the ground at pretty close range, which is the perfect cap to Lou's footage. And Lou is just glowing over that, over the body of his partner, before he takes his camera. It's so sad. It's the fact that is the guy that get punished. But that the other two main characters in this movie just go on to have media careers. But that guy, but just because he wanted a fucking $30 a night to maybe at some point not sleep in a storage unit. And that's what he got for it.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for listening to this special Pride edition of Dead Times with Jake Gyllenhaal. Sometimes, Tim, I'm going to have to give you a list of the Jake Gyllenhaal movies to watch, which is all of them.
Okay.
But so I hope you're having a happy Pride, and good night.
Night, everybody.
I've been yours, Peter.
I continue to be Tim.
Good night.
I forgot how we ended the show. I said goodnight already.
Yeah, I kind of did too.
So,
it's been a while since we've recorded.